Well, should we get started? I mean, according to my clock, it's exactly 3 o'clock. But do I want to wait for people to straggle, or should we just get started? Okay, cool. Because last year I did a talk, kind of lots and lots of Mormon stuff. And I tried to cover kind of the whole entire playing field, and it went on for 3 hours. This time what I've tried to do is pick a little bit more of a constrained subject so that we can get through it in an hour or an hour and a half. But I want to get started because it's very likely that it'll go on and on and on. So we'll see.
What dinner is at 6?
Dinner is at, yes. I will have you out of here by then. I really am aiming for an hour and a half, I swear. Okay, well, all right, let me start with a news item. I don't know if you guys caught this. I don't know if this is news for you. A news item hit on December 19th or thereabouts a few months ago. This is from JTA.org, and now that I think about it, I don't know exactly what that stands for, Jewish something or other. Mormons baptized Simon Wiesenthal. The Simon Wiesenthal Center called on the Mormon Church to remove its Nazi hunter namesake from the church's online database of posthumous baptisms. Rabbi Marvin Heyer here, dean of the Wiesenthal Center, made the urgent request after being informed by Salt Lake City researcher Helen Radke that Wiesenthal's name had been added about a week ago to the Mormons' International Genealogical Index. Quote, "We are astounded and dismayed that after assurances and promises by the Mormon Church, Mr. Wiesenthal's life and memory, along with so many other Jews, would be trampled and disregarded," end quote, here said. Wiesenthal, quote, "proudly lived as a Jew, died as a Jew, demanded justice for the millions of the victims of the Holocaust, and, at his request, was buried in the State of Israel," he said. Continuing the quotation, "It is sacrilegious for the Mormon faith to desecrate his memory by suggesting that Jews, on their own, are not worthy enough to receive God's eternal blessing," end quote. Here also urged the Utah-based church to remove the names of all other Holocaust victims from the list. Many Jews, including Holocaust victims, have been found in the index. Mormon officials promised in 1995 to stop the practice of posthumously baptizing Jews, Holocaust victims, but did not. They reiterated the pledge in 2000. On the same day, the LA Times reported this. This is written by K. Connie Kang, Times staff writer, December 19, 2006. Mormons removed Wiesenthal from baptism database. A potential conflict between Jewish organizations and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints over vicarious baptism was averted Monday when the church said that Simon Wiesenthal's name was removed from the church's genealogical records. The Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles had demanded earlier in the day that Wiesenthal's name be removed from the church's online International Genealogical Index, the church's database of posthumous ordinances for vicarious baptisms. Actually, it's more than that. We'll get into that. I read this quote from the other news story. "We are astounded and dismayed that after assurances and promises by the Mormon Church, Simon Wiesenthal was one of the great Jews of the post-Holocaust period. He proudly lived as a Jew, died as a Jew, demanded justice for millions of the victims of the Holocaust, and had at his request was buried in the State of Israel. It is sacrilegious for the Mormon faith to desecrate his memory." Okay, I read that already. Within hours after Heyer released this statement to the press, Mormon Church spokesman Bruce Olson said Wiesenthal's name had been removed from the International Index. Quote, "In response to a request by the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and in accordance with the commitments the church made in 1995, no church ordinance was performed for Simon Wiesenthal, and his name was immediately removed from the International Genealogical Index," Olson said in a statement. If you guys stick around until I'm all done, I will tell you why that's problematic. Heyer said he was happy to receive the reassurance from a top church official. Olson said the Mormon Church, quote, "continues to emphasize," end quote, "its policy that church members submit only names of their own ancestors to the index, a step toward vicarious baptisms. After a 1995 agreement with Jewish groups, church officials have said that the names of several hundred thousand Holocaust victims have been removed from its genealogical database. Now, what I want to do in the next hour and a half is try to kind of give you the Mormon story about why Mormons are doing this. I cannot realistically give you the Jewish perspective beyond what I've kind of read, because that's not my background, but I am, and was for most of my life, for most of my life, I was a practicing member of the Mormon Church. I stopped believing in the mid-90s, formally had my name removed in 2001, and now regard myself as an ex-Mormon. So what I want to do is, like I say, I want to kind of give you the Mormon view of what happened and why, and in the process give you some history into Mormon thought and Utah history and so on. So what I want to do is run through quickly my what I'm about to tell you agenda so that you can see where I'm going with this. When I get to my introduction, I'll give you kind of more of my story. And then I want to kind of give you an overview of what Mormon temples are for, tell you what a Mormon temple is and what it isn't. And since we happen to live in Los Angeles, I'll give you a little bit of Los Angeles temple history. And I'll tell you about what Mormons are doing when they're talking about baptisms, endowments, and sealings, and why that's important to them. Then I'll move from that away from temples into genealogy, into family history centers, why family history centers exist, why the church makes its resources available to you. In doing so, I'm kind of separating two very interconnected threads. Family history research and temple, the existence of temples and the temple and the ordinances that take place in temples are for Mormons very intertwined. And as I try to separate them, I'm invariably going to have to kind of point to each of the two different concepts. But I'm going to try to split them apart so we can talk about them in some sort of an order. And then I'm going to close with after you've kind of had all this background, I'm going to close with more of a discussion of what exactly happened in 1995, and what exactly happened in 2000, and what exactly happened in 2006, and you know what the Jews complained about, what the Mormons did in response, and what they didn't do, and why. To start with, I'm going to get in my groove here in a minute, and then I'm not going to sound so nervous. But to start with, I am on the board of GLAM, of the local Los Angeles chapter. I'm also the webmaster and the calendar editor, and I'm also on the board of another nonprofit known as the Ex-Mormon Foundation. What that mean? Who's giggling? No, seriously, the Ex-Mormon Foundation, okay, it's a small group, I grant you that, but it serves a very important purpose, and I'm, you know, proud to be on the board. But what I want to make sure is clear is that I'm not here on behalf of the foundation. I'm not speaking for them. Mensa doesn't endorse the Ex-Mormon Foundation because Mensa has no opinions, as you know. The Ex-Mormon Foundation doesn't endorse Mensa out of sort of spite. If you're not going to endorse, no, I'm just kidding. But I am solely responsible for everything that I'm about to say. I don't speak for the Mormon Church. I don't speak for the Foundation. I don't speak for GLAM. I'm just here speaking, giving you kind of my perspective on what's going on. And I say that because I don't want there to be any confusion. I'm sure that, you know, somebody's going to freak out because I'm talking about temple mysteries. And I just want to make sure you all know that don't blame GLAM and don't blame anybody else. Blame me. Send me your hate mail. I know in some of the presentations that I've been at in previous RGs and today and so on, people kind of like to get through their presentation and then ask for questions at the end. I'm not like that. Please interrupt me at any moment. Tell me, ask me questions, because then I kind of feel like we're dialoguing and I don't really feel like I'm... was that a question?
Yeah, I'm
okay.
The first thing you said, it seems to me that the Mormon Church now has given, in their own belief, the honor to the Holocaust victims and to Simon Wiesenthal's victims, regardless of whether they believe that themselves. At least for the Mormon Church, these people being honored and their people being saved and all that from the Mormon point of view. And it seems to me, even the rabbi there is sort of forcing the Mormons to be anti-Semitic by not having them honor.
See, this is exactly why I'm that whole bit that I just read, I labeled it as a teaser for a reason. It is a teaser. I want you to stick around till I get to the end of the presentation when we'll get through all that stuff. But yes, I understand. I totally understand that from looking at it from an outside perspective, looking outside it, you know, looking in on Mormonism, it looks very strange. What the heck was that all about? And I'm going to try to explain it to you in the next hour and a half. And if you have to leave halfway through, it's your own fault. So, also, I'm recording this talk. I recorded the talk last year. I told you that last year. And I posted it on the Ex-Mormon Foundation website, so you can go listen to what I talked about last year if you want to hear it. But I'm letting you know that so that in case you ask any questions, if you don't want your question to show up in the recording, tell me and I'll cut it out before I upload it. But I think that's kind of all I wanted to cover as far as getting started. And I think I've kind of told you my story. I haven't gone into a lot of detail about why I left the Mormon Church, because that would kind of stray far, you know, afield. I want to kind of stick to family history and temple work. So if you have, and that's another thing too, is if you have questions about Mormonism that pertain to either family history or temple work, great. If it's going to be something unrelated, like, you know, blacks in the priesthood or something that's not related to the, actually, blacks in the priesthood could be, depending on how you form the question. But let's save that for afterwards, and I'll talk to you all night long if you want to. But let's keep questions about family history and temple work for the next hour and a half. With that said, is there anything that you want to be sure that I cover after having told you where I think I'm going? Is there anything you want me to focus on or not focus on or skip over? Okay, with that, let's go. I want to start by making sure that we're all clear on terminology. I more than once in my life, I've had the experience of having people tell me that there is a temple in their neighborhood. Mormons do not refer to temples as meeting houses and do not refer to meeting houses as temples. The terminology for a meeting house in Mormon jargon is either a ward building or a stake center, but never a temple. Temples have a special purpose. Until recently, there were only about 40 or 50 of them in the world. And we're going to talk about what that purpose is. But we don't, as Mormons, we don't talk about going to temple or going to that temple on a weekly basis. We talk, that's something you do over and above your weekly worship, you know, ceremony. Just so you know, because like the only temple in Los Angeles until very recently was the one, the big building on Santa Monica Boulevard. In the last few years, they've built additional ones, particularly in Newport Beach, and we'll get to that in a bit too. But when Mormons talk about going to church on Sunday, they're not talking about the temple. That's really kind of the point that I want to make sure we're clear on. The temple, like I say, has a very specialized purpose within Mormonism. In the very early days of the church, and for those of you who don't know, the church was founded in 1830, and its first temple was dedicated in 1836. I have been to that temple. It's really very different from temples that are from every other temple that they've built since. And the reason for that is that the ordinances that we're about to talk about hadn't really fully evolved by the time the Kirtland Temple was built. And so if you walk into the Kirtland Temple, there are not the ordinance rooms for the endowment and the ceilings and so forth that there are in the temple today, in every other temple except for that one. The Kirtland Temple was really kind of built to be the communal center. At the time, in 1836, the church was headquartered in Kirtland, Ohio, and the temple was supposed to be kind of, you know, the center of their community, but it was really kind of a big church. It was really just kind of a big, you know, overgrown church, and it wasn't, it didn't have the same meaning that temples have today. In 1838, the Mormons were kicked out of Ohio, and wound up eventually in a town on the riverbanks of in Illinois, which they basically built from scratch and named Nauvoo. The story of the building of the Nauvoo Temple is actually kind of an interesting one. I don't want to dwell on it too much, but by this time, because I'm an ex-Mormon, okay, I'm going to start talking about how Joseph Smith's theology evolved and he invented certain ideas. Your Mormon friends are going to refer to this as revelation. God revealed this idea to Joseph Smith at this time. I don't look at it like that, and I apologize. You know, I'm going to give you a slightly different story than your Mormon friends will. But by the late 1830s, early 1840s, Joseph Smith was beginning to consider the question of what happens to people after they die. In other words, he had already established that baptism is essential for salvation. Not only do you have to be baptized, you have to be baptized by immersion, and most importantly, you have to be baptized by someone holding the divine authority to perform the baptism, because if it's performed by anybody else who doesn't have God's authority, it's non-valid. So Joseph Smith is now looking at the question of, what do we do about all the people who have lived before what Mormons refer to as the restoration of the gospel in 1830? And in 1838, he records what he calls a vision. In my opinion, this is basically him contemplating the problem and coming to a realization, but Mormons will refer to this as a revelation or a vision, in which an older brother of his, whom he loved very much but who died before reaching adulthood, Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, was very concerned about what's going to happen to him since he wasn't able to be baptized with the proper authority. And in this revelation, is Joseph Smith records that those who would have received the gospel if they had been permitted to live will be allowed all the blessings of that all the rest of us will be able to. But his theology hadn't quite evolved yet to the point where he understood how that was going to happen. And then in 1840, he started preaching this concept of baptism by proxy, baptism for and in behalf of a deceased individual, where the deceased individual doesn't have a body, therefore can't be baptized, but baptism is essential. So we, the living, can be baptized on their behalf. And so as they settled in Nauvoo and built up the city of Nauvoo in Illinois, Joseph Smith made it very clear that we want to build another one of these central buildings, but this time we wanted to have rooms in it that in which we can be doing these ordinances for the dead. And he recorded, again, what he called a revelation, in which he said, if you don't build this building, and I'm paraphrasing, I should probably open it up and read you exactly what he says. Basically, he's saying, if you don't build this building, I'm just going to wipe a lot of you out, and you're not going to be my church anymore. Well, in 1844, Joseph Smith was jailed, and a mob stormed the jail and killed him. Mormons refer to this as a martyrdom. Ex-Mormons refer to this as Joseph Smith and his philandering got found out. The truth is probably somewhere in between. But Joseph Smith is now gone in 1844, and the state of Illinois orders them out of the state, and this begins their migration into Utah. But they've got this temple that's half built that they haven't finished yet, and they know that they have to finish it and complete these ordinances, otherwise God is going to abandon them as a church. So they literally finished the temple on their way out of town and performed an estimated 5,000 ordinances, baptisms and endowments in that temple before they left. And then they just abandoned the building along with the rest of the city. The Nauvoo Temple no longer stands, the original one. Now the Mormon Church has built another temple on top of where the old one used to be. But for several decades, the site of the Nauvoo Temple was simply just a barren field. When the Mormons then migrated from Illinois to Utah, they arrived in 1847 and immediately picked out a spot in the Salt Lake Valley that was going to be the main center, again, the center of the community. It was going to be the main temple in downtown Salt Lake. And that temple took, am I doing the math right? That temple took 35 years to build. And it was finally dedicated in 1893. In the meantime, they built three more temples elsewhere in Utah, smaller ones, kind of as sort of a, we need to have some place to do our temple ordinances. But Mormons consider the main temple in Salt Lake City to be kind of the center of the universe as far as temple work and family history is concerned. Now, By 1890, yes.
Why are all the temples that see the one in San Diego, the one here, that one, why is it so
ostentatious? Ostentatious?
Yeah.
This is, Mormons consider this to be the house of the Lord. The Mormons really, I mean, the meeting houses are just chapels. This is the house of the Lord. This is, for Mormons, and nothing is too good for the Lord, right? This is, we want to make sure the Lord knows that we're, you know, and that's really all it boils down to. They knew that this building was going to last for a very long time. They built it out of granite, and they knew that this was going to be kind of their symbol, for their central symbol for their faith for, from then on. And so, yeah, they didn't want to just build a shack. They wanted to build something that looked very impressive and was going to... But they do. I mean, they look very... Even today, when they build temples, they put them in really expensive neighborhoods, and they make them really big, and they put big spotlights on them, so you can't miss them.
One in San Diego, when they opened them, in one of the colonists, he referred to somebody who was driving by with a kid said that it's God's rocket ship.
I need to get some water. Yeah, I remember when the San Diego Temple opened, and my reaction, and the woman who was my wife at the time, we both referred to it as something out of Star Wars. And I'm going to show you this picture, and you'll see what I mean. For the longest time, these were the only temples that the church operated, were these four in Utah. And then in the early part of the 20th century, they built a few more, five more, and then the 10th one, if you don't count Kirtland and Nauvoo, was here in Los Angeles. You've all seen this building, you know what I'm talking about, but I figured I'd put a picture in there anyway just so it doesn't get overlooked. I will come back to this a little later. In California, in 1964, they opened one in Oakland, and then here's the one in San Diego in 1993. Now, yeah, this looks like something straight out of episode one, you know? But if you're on the inside of this building, there's actually all that stained glass windowing actually looks really freaking cool on the inside, just so you know. But yeah, this building, as you're heading down I-5 on your way to San Diego, is just like right there, and you can't miss it, and yeah, it does. It looks kind of... like I say, there was the building of temples was actually kind of a slow growth thing until very recently. We'll get to that in a bit. There's seven in California now. Three of them were built, you know, the third one was built in 1993, and then there's like four more all of a sudden, bing, 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 really recently. There are 124 worldwide. Half of those are inside the United States. And there's the map of where they all are on the West Coast. But the growth has been really phenomenal, especially in the last decade. Very slow, only 8 by 1950, 40 by 1986, 43 by 1999, by the beginning of 1999. But within the single year of 1999, there were an extra, now to do the math, 25. And then in the year 2000, there was another 30 added. Now, those were... we ex-Mormons refer to them as mixed temples, which is kind of not really very respectful, but they're much smaller, and the idea is supposed to be that this way temples will kind of fill the earth, and there's, you know, little ones everywhere, so that there you have so that you, no matter where you live, have a much greater likelihood of having one close by. Mormons also kind of like to tell themselves that the fact that they are the fastest growing church in the world makes them true. Now, I don't understand the logic, but that's how they think, right? But the thing that's interesting is that they're not the fastest growing church in the world, although their press releases say they are. But building all these temples is kind of proof that they are. I will send you a website if you catch me afterwards. I need to look it up. But there's a really good website that has all those statistics that I know where it is, but I have to look it up. So catch me. Don't let me forget that question. But the rate has kind of slowed down, because like between 2000 and now, we went from 102 to 124. So that's 22 in, you know, in 6 years. But still, that's a lot compared to how long it took them to build the first 22. It's totally privately funded, yeah. Your tax money is not... Well, okay, I got this question last year and I didn't understand it because I gave the wrong answer to this question. The question is our tax money being used to pay for the temples that are being built? And the answer is yes and no. No, in the sense that the church is entirely self-funded. The church requires of its faithful believing members 10% of their income as tithing. Time magazine did a story in, I think, 1997, where they estimated that amounts to about $6 billion a year. The church is not hurting for funds, which is how they're able to put these temples in very nice neighborhoods. The only way that you are paying for it is in the sense that you're paying for every other church in the country, because churches don't pay taxes. You know, but other than that, they pay their own way. And that includes all the family history stuff we're going to talk about, too. We're going to talk about this huge program they have of microfilming records. We're going to talk about this huge program they have of storing those in a big granite vault in Utah, and making those films available to everybody. And all of that is basically self-funded, too, with the exception that if you order a microfilm and, have it sent to your local family history center, you have to pay, like, a processing fee. But they pay for everything. The Los Angeles Temple, just to kind of, just because we're in Los Angeles, was the land for it was purchased in 1937. They couldn't build right away because of the war, but they ended up building that building between 1951 and 1956, where it's been mostly unchanged ever since. This particular website has some interesting, changes that have gone on internally, but it was, when it was built, the largest temple at the time, the largest temple that the church had at the time, and remained that way for a while, but I don't remember how long. It's huge, both inside and out, and that gives them a lot of there's a lot of room there for them to put a visitor center, and there's sort of a garden around there where you can walk. But the reason why it's important for this presentation is that there's also a huge family history center on the grounds there. Family History Center and the Visitor Center and all that stuff's open to the public. The only thing you can't do is actually go inside the temple. Is that what I wanted to do? Yeah. Okay, so just kind of the natural breaking point. Does anybody have any questions so far? Yes. The question is, when was the temple in well, there are two in Hawaii. Let's back up a little bit and go back to that map. There's two in Hawaii. There's one in Kona, there's one in Lehi. Is that the one you're talking about? I don't know how to pronounce it. I'll take your word for it. That one, if I remember correctly, that's the one that was built in 1911. And the reason why that one is cool is because if you remember Hawaii 5-0, the beginning, intro to Hawaii 5-0, there was, like, for 2 seconds, there was a camera shot of that temple. So Mormons think that's kind of cool. I have in my papers up here somewhere a printout of every single one of the 124 temples and when they were dedicated. So that if you have that question about any other temples too, I have the printout. I can hand it around, or you can come up and see it later. Yeah, this is something that I don't quite know as well as I should. I'm gonna make a really good educated guess as to why they built that quickly. And it is this: if you know anything at all about the Book of Mormon, you know that the Book of Mormon claims to be a history of the ancient American and Polynesian people. Of course, it isn't. I can go on for days about why it isn't. But I did that last year, so it's not. But the Mormons feel a great affinity for Native Americans and Polynesians, not to the point of embracing their culture, but to the point of wanting to voice Mormon culture on them. But they're you know, this idea of preaching the gospel to what they call the Lamanites, in other words, the people of the Book of Mormon, to bring them back to Christ. This is something the Mormons have always taken very seriously. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly why 1911 exactly, but yeah, they wanted to kind of go out there and reach out to the Polynesian people, and Hawaii at that point was not part of the United States. Question?
So what's the Mormon attitude toward Jews?
Say again?
What's the Mormon attitude toward Jews?
See, this is the kind of question where if we go off on that kind of topic, we're gonna get a little bit far away from the topic at hand. But no, it actually does relate though, because it brings us back to Simon Wiesenthal. Mormons believe that. Mormons believe that, you know, the Jews had the gospel originally, and they lost it. But Mormons kind of recognize that their origins originate with the same origins that, you know, the Jewish religion originates. I'm not making any sense. They do kind of understand that the Jews were the chosen people at one point in time. They lost it, and Jesus came and organized his church, and that was the chosen people for a while, but they lost it. And then God came and restored true religion through Joseph Smith in 1830. So the Mormons kind of realize that the Jews used to be the chosen people, and they kind of want to reach out to them, and they kind of want to bring the gospel to them, but they very much understand that the Jews don't want that. So there's kind of this, we don't really know exactly how to handle that. Does that make sense? I mean, we want to bring the gospel to the Jews, but they don't want it. So Mormons have... Mormons went to a lot of trouble to get the BYU Study Center in Jerusalem. And they went to Jerusalem and they said, look, we're not here to proselytize. We proselytize. We promise we won't send missionaries around. The only thing we want to do is just send people here to study, because we've got a lot of people that are interested in, you know, Israel and Jerusalem and so on, because, you know, all of those common heritage that, you know, the Old and the New Testaments have, you know, a direct bearing on what Mormons talk about every Sunday. But Israel was very nervous about this whole idea because they didn't want this to be a foothold for Mormons to come in sending missionaries. So my understanding, and I don't think this has changed since I left the church, but my understanding is that Mormons are allowed to send students over there as long as they keep to themselves and don't try to engage anybody in a discussion about the Mormon gospel. But am I answering your question? Does that kind of make sense? It's kind of a weird sort of a... I don't know how well I'm explaining it, but okay. Yeah.
Can we get back to the temple for a minute?
Okay.
I understand from other people that new temples are built on a higher elevation than the surrounding area. And LA and San Diego certainly are.
Yeah.
And I can't picture Fresno. I don't think there's a hill within 100 miles of Fresno.
I don't remember that necessarily being one of the rules. There are a number of rules that I do know about. Like, if you're going to have the angel statue, like there's an angel on the steeple of the Los Angeles Temple, and that angel is known. Mormonism refers to that as the angel Moroni. We can get into why later, but ask me after class. That was originally positioned facing the street. And the president of the church at the time said, no, it's supposed to face east. So they actually rotated it so that it faces east. There's little things like that that temples have to have, but I don't necessarily know that the elevation is one of them. I just don't know.
Newport had to reduce the height of the angel.
I heard that about Boston. Boston had a really big problem because they were going to put this steeple that was frickin' 1,000 miles high. And Boston said, no, you can't do that. But I hadn't heard that about you said Fresno?
Newport Beach.
It makes sense. I mean, the Mormon church would love to have all of its steeples go all the way up to the sky, but...
Did this doctrine come from England, or was it all developed in the United States?
There are some things we could talk about. Emanuel Swedenborg has been identified by ex-Mormons, not by Mormons, as one of many potential influences on the theology of Joseph Smith. I don't know where else in England you might be thinking of, but Emanuel Swedenborg is one that comes to mind from, you know, over there. What did you have in mind specifically?
Well, I've got some Mormon relatives. They asked me to do some investigations when I was down in the area of Crystal and everything like that.
Well, that means that they have.
We're all either Church of England or Methodist.
Sure, but see, Mormons. See, when we get to this, we're going to talk about how Mormons are researching their ancestry, right?
Yeah.
And Mormons did a lot of recruiting in England, in Germany, in Scandinavia. My surname is Scandinavian. My ancestry is Danish because, I guess I didn't mention this, but all my ancestors, they're all handcart pioneers. They all came over to Utah from England or from Europe in the 1850s, carrying up their belongings in handcarts because the railroad didn't go there yet. But all my ancestry goes through Scandinavia.
They being as Mormons.
Yeah. Right.
From
in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, and you know, in particular, Mormons sent missionaries to Europe and elsewhere, but especially to Europe, which means that a lot of current Mormons have ancestry in, you know, England and Scandinavia and Germany. So what they were undoubtedly asking you to do was look into their ancestry, but that doesn't necessarily mean that their ancestors, you know, after, you know, past a certain point were not Mormon. Oh, really? Okay, we're straying from the temple thing again. We can talk about that afterwards, though. Come talk to me later, and we'll talk about that, because I have ancestors in those companies, too. Okay, so, where were we? Now, I want to talk about what goes on inside the temple, and as a preface, as a prelude to that, I need to give you kind of a concept of what Mormons think of when they think of salvation on behalf of the dead. Now, like I told you earlier, Joseph Smith was kind of evolving this concept. This concept was kind of, you know, rolling around in his brain in the late 1830s and early 1840s prior to his death. But it had pretty much solidified by the time he died as follows. Joseph Smith claimed that... I want to read you something to kind of help make some sense out of some of this. The very last two verses of the Old Testament as recorded in the King James Bible. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Now again, I'm not Jewish. I've never been Jewish. I don't fully understand what I'm about to tell you. I've simply read about it. You all can tell me if I'm crazy. But it is my understanding that at Passover, Jews, when they're celebrating Passover, they set aside a seat for Elijah because they're expecting him to come back someday. Joseph Smith appropriated this idea and claimed on the day of Passover in 1836 that Elijah returned to him in the Kirtland Temple and gave him the authority to, quote-unquote, turn the hearts of the children to their fathers and turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, which Joseph Smith interpreted to mean that we, the living, need to... reach out to our deceased ancestors and provide them the benefits of baptism, etc. And I'm going to talk about what etc. is later, but imagine various saving ordinances such as baptism, and I'll talk about, you know, endowments and sealings later, but imagine that there's a whole slew of these things that Mormons believe are necessary for salvation that you have to do while you're alive, and if you don't do it while you're alive, how do we extend those ordinances to people that don't have bodies anymore? The appearance of Elijah to Joseph Smith in 1836 opened up basically gave Joseph Smith gave him the authority to perform ordinances on behalf of the dead. However, even in the days of Joseph Smith, this is not kind of a recent, you know, this is not kind of a recent invention to kind of smooth over difficulties with Jewish groups and others. But even way back when it began, the idea was that the deceased are up in heaven waiting for their opportunity to learn the gospel, accept the gospel, and when they accept the gospel, to accept the blessings of baptism. But the baptisms that we do by proxy here on earth do not take effect until they are accepted by the deceased. So one of the misconceptions that I kind of want to get, make sure that we don't still have, is the idea that I've heard people tell me, which is that baptism for the dead kind of forces dead people into the Mormon church, because it doesn't. The idea in Mormon thought, what we're doing is making them making the baptisms available to them if they choose to accept them. Does that all make sense? It's a voluntary thing all the way around. But what Mormons believe, though, is you can't just, and this would make everything so much simpler if they could just say, once and for all, I'm just going to declare everybody who's dead, they can just accept baptism, and we don't have to go through all this process of figuring out who they are, taking their name to the temple, being baptized on their behalf, because it's a long, I mean, there's millions and billions of dead people, you know. Mormons are absolutely convinced you have to find the name and their date and place of birth before you can have them baptized. Now, so, and that, well, we'll get to that in a minute.
Well, can I ask one question?
Sure.
The active Mormons believe that the farther they can get back into their ancestors and get them baptized, they can get farther into heaven themselves, the active Mormons?
No. Mormons have a very different... It is true that Mormons have this idea that they need to do things to earn their way, to get their way into heaven. But non-Mormons who are at this, you know, who are at one extreme, who say grace is all you need and you don't have to do anything, are kind of at this end of the spectrum. And Mormons who say no, grace is not sufficient all by itself, you have to do things before you can get into heaven, are kind of over here. But the people who are over here who are, you know, saying that grace is all you need and you don't need to actually do anything misrepresent what the Mormons are trying to do. Because the saved by grace people are looking at the Mormons going, you know, they think they're, you know, ticking off this checklist and they're going to get in, and the more they do, the better they're going to be. It's really not like that. There are a certain number of things that Mormons have to do. They have to be baptized. They have to be married in the temple. They have to be endowed. They have to accept the priesthood, they have to be, you know, faithful all their lives, and they have to give 10% of their income to the church, and there's some things they have to do, but it's not quite like that. It's not like there's, you know, if I do more than you, I'm better than you, and I get to be more of a god in the afterlife than you are. I guess I didn't explain that, but Mormons believe that they will be gods in the hereafter. It's just, you become God, and if you accept the Mormon teachings and you do what the Mormon Church wants you to do, you become God. And if you're a God and I'm a God, we're both gods. It's not like you're any more of a God than I am. See, Mormons don't think of it like that. Mormons figure if you go through this life and you do what the Mormon Church wants you to do and you become God, or you become a God, that's it. You've arrived, and everybody's equal after that. Does that make sense? Okay. Question.
Are those gods that you just spoke of, are they the equivalent in their world to the previous slide when you said Heavenly Father?
Yes.
They're equivalent to that Heavenly Father. So when you become a god after you die, you set up an entire different system.
Exactly. Mormons, you may have heard this, and it's absolutely true. Mormons believe that as God is, man may become, and as God is, and as man is, God once was. Okay, the God that Mormons worship, and Jehovah, Elohim, whoever the heck he is, because there's some questions about that, and we'll get into that later. Ask me after class. But whoever that Heavenly Father God is, used to be just like you and me, right? And
he's not a universal God. He's the God that's responsible for people on earth.
Right. Well, Mormons haven't really answered that question satisfactorily either. How big is God's universe? But all the Mormons really know for sure is that when they become gods, they will have what will be called a universe, and they will, you know, they will be gods over that, whatever that is, right?
I mean, so people who are waiting who have not been baptized after they lost their bodies have not achieved that state.
Right. You have to be, in order to get to that state, you have to be baptized, you have to be endowed, you have to be sealed, okay? So, pick an example. Alexander the Great hasn't, if he hasn't been baptized, hasn't been endowed, hasn't been sealed, he's sitting in kind of a waiting area in the spirit world, waiting for these ordinances to take place. And as soon as they do take place, and he accepts the gospel and accepts Jesus Christ as his Savior and all that kind of stuff, he's on the road to what Mormons call exaltation, which means that he's going to be exalted as a god. Okay? I don't know why I picked Alexander the Great, but just, you know, John Doe, somebody.
These people who are waiting, I'm thinking the whole thing seems to be involved a great act of faith upon the Mormon who lives today. Because it's almost like, here I am doing this baptism for the dead.
Yeah.
The dead, if they're already in heaven, they know if this is all true or not. And for all we know, we're baptizing and they're all saying, oh, gee, that wasn't really the way it was. And, I mean, you really have to believe that.
Yeah, and yes, you do. And the more into Mormonism you are, the more convinced you are that this is an absolutely essential thing that you're doing on behalf of the dead. That, it is an act of faith, and you are absolutely convinced that the dead are sitting around anxiously waiting for you to get their temple work done because they are at a barrier, a standstill. They cannot progress where they are because they're stuck because their ordinance has not been done. And so you, in doing the temple ordinances for on behalf of the dead, you are given the feeling that you are really a liberator. You are liberating them from what amounts to a prison in the spirit world. You're giving them the ability to continue their journey toward exaltation. And they are, and Mormons believe that the dead who have not had their temple work done are sitting around waiting for us to get around to doing their temple work. But yeah, it is an act of faith, and getting Mormons involved in this kind of temple work really has a very has the effect of getting everybody entrenched, invested in the Mormon cause. Because yeah, the more you do the temple work, the more convinced you are that it's true, and it emboldens your faith. If that makes sense. Does that make sense? Okay. Anything
well,
else?
Well, a little bit that you see them as being in prison because if there is some great secret that's revealed that maybe this is all wrong, but they're still in the prison, they don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
They're not in heaven.
Right. Okay. So, this is taken from official church literature, and it basically says ordinances don't take effect until the deceased accept them, but the deceased can't accept them until we do them first. Okay. Yeah.
On that quote that you had up, it's talking about church members have responsibility to provide these ordinances for their own and temple family.
Uh-huh. Yes.
What do Mormons think will happen for those people that
don't have
their line is gone?
I'm going to get to that. I am going to get to that when we talk about the history of family history in the church. And it's a really very interesting topic, but hang, hold that thought, because I will get to it. Question?
Can women become gods?
Yes.
All members of family
can become gods? Uh-huh. Yes. Mormons, yeah. And okay, so for the sake of the recording, the question is, what about women? Can women become gods? And yes, they can. Mormonism has hidden within it, I mean, it's really not something the Mormons missionaries will tell you when they first show up at your door. But Mormonism has a heavenly father and a heavenly mother and their son, Jesus Christ. Okay? Heavenly father has a wife. In fact, if you press the Mormon missionaries, they will tell you that heavenly father actually has several wives because he's polygamous. Okay? So yes, the Mormon idea was that the guy we call Heavenly Father was a human being at one point in the past, lived polygamously, and he and all of his wives were exalted together. I swear it's the truth. I was there. I've been there. I'm not making this up. Yes, Alan.
Has there ever been a Mormon person who tried to do that with somebody who was dead? wall saying, please do not proselytize?
Not that I'm aware of. On the contrary, I have heard many, many stories of people who go to the temple and come away saying, I felt the presence of the person that I was doing the temple work for. The Mormons kind of have, they come away from the temple with this feeling that they've had a spiritual experience or a spiritual encounter with someone who was waiting for them to do the temple work on their behalf. Does that make sense? I mean, that's the feeling people walk away with. Now, yes.
You mentioned that Mormons believe in God and in life and Jesus. What about Holy Ghost?
So, okay.
The Trinity and the Christianity.
Yes, they do, but they believe. Okay, the question is, do they believe in a Father and a Son and the Holy Ghost? The answer is yes, they do. They are separate beings. The Father and the Son have bodies of flesh and bone. The Holy Ghost does not, but He will eventually. So, for example, that Mormon baptisms, when you're baptized into the Mormon Church, the exact wording is, having been committed, let's say I'm baptizing you, right, because I have the authority to do baptism, well, I don't anymore, but I mean I did, have the authority to do baptism, so I'm baptizing you. I'm going to dunk you underwater, because it has to be by immersion, and the words that I say as I do that are, having been commissioned of Jesus Christ, I baptize you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the Holy Ghost, amen. So yeah, they do. That answers that question. Question in the back. No, we're not really worshiping the Mormons are not really worshiping their ancestors. They are. It's a little different from that. Mormons consider themselves to be assistants in the work of saving other people. They are the language they use is borrowed from the Old Testament. They refer to themselves as saviors upon Mount Zion. They are offering salvation. They are helping to offer salvation to other people in the same way that Jesus offers salvation to us, if that makes sense. But they're not worshiping their ancestors in the way that, I don't know, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't characterize it that way. Okay, you've all read this. These are from two different sources. Mormons often like to quote them together, but they were said at different times. And then Joseph Smith also said, this is something we cannot take lightly, and this is actually canonized in Mormon scripture. This is something we cannot take lightly because it's essential for us to do. Okay, so you get the idea. Now, there are four main ordinances that take place in the temple. There are some other minor ones, washing and anointing and clothing and the garment of the holy priesthood that I won't get into, but there are four big ones that are the main important ones. The first one is baptism. As I've said, in Mormonism, baptism has to be done by the proper authority. It has to be done by immersion. And it, you know, dates back to the beginnings of the church. It wasn't until 1840 that Joseph Smith started talking about baptisms on behalf of the dead. And as I mentioned, they didn't have a temple to do it in until 1846, after Joseph Smith was dead. So the first real baptisms for the dead took place in 1846, but the introduction of the concept dates to 1840. And just to kind of finish the thought, when you're baptizing somebody, okay, so if you're going to do a baptism for the dead, it's the same as doing a baptism for the living, except you would come to the temple, and I'd be in the temple doing the baptism, right? But now you're doing a baptism not for yourself, but you're doing it in behalf of a deceased ancestor, you know, Jane Austen or something. And so the language in that case is, having been commissioned of Jesus Christ, I baptize you for and in behalf of Jane Austen, who is dead, in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, amen. So it's basically the same concept, but you're doing it on behalf of somebody else. Now, the baptism is one that you're all probably kind of familiar with, because everybody knows what baptism is. Then there's, track of the time, so I'm not. Okay. Then there's the endowment. The endowment, depending on whether you talk to a believing Mormon or an ex-Mormon, the endowment serve different purposes depending on who you talk to. Believing Mormons are not really sure what started the endowment. I mean, they're not exactly sure where it came from. They don't have a story of origin for the endowment the way they do for the Book of Mormon or the way they do for the restoration of the priesthood or anything. Mormons kind of grow up in my case, sort of grew up in the church kind of knowing the endowment was there, but you never get told this was the miraculous occurrence that brought us the endowment. And I think the reason why that is because the real origins of the endowment are kind of shady. And now I'm speaking as an ex-Mormon. Joseph Smith had been recently introduced to Freemasonry and did kind of the first three, you know, intros to Freemasonry, and at the same time was trying to introduce this concept of being married to multiple wives and keeping it a secret. And so what he figured out was that if he could get his associates to all kind of be in this secret brotherhood with him and keep his secret, it wouldn't get out to the public and he wouldn't get in trouble for it and wouldn't get arrested and get killed. Unfortunately, he did get arrested and get killed, but that's another story. The endowment for Joseph Smith was a way of kind of keeping his inner circle close. And it was, and is, a blending of Old Testament and New Testament concepts and ideas with what Joseph Smith had picked up in from Freemasonry. Now, I don't want to get into specific details about the handshakes that go on in the temple. I will tell you that they are there. I'll also tell you that they're easily located on the internet, but I'm not going to go into them here and now because I want to at least try to be respectful to the believing Mormons who consider that the most sacred part of the endowment ceremony. But I will tell you this. I had a really cool opportunity. See, the Mormons will not tell you that the endowment has its roots in Freemasonry. Or if they do, they'll say in very hushed whispers, and then they'll insist that it has nothing to do with, that the endowment has really nothing to do with Freemasonry. And it's only if you really press somebody who knows what they're talking about that you'll get kind of a hushed admission that, well, maybe there's something to it. I had just moved to Los Angeles in the spring of 2003, and an ex-Mormon friend of mine had made arrangements with a guy who is the Grand Lodge Master Mason for Santa Monica, for the Santa Monica Masonic Temple, and he took us on a tour. There were about 9 or 10 of us who were ex-Mormons who went on this tour, and it was kind of a privately guided tour of the Masonic Temple in Santa Monica. He was not at liberty to reveal anything that was Masonic. But he was happy to tell us when something that we knew from the endowment ceremony was not Masonic. So you could pretty much tell what was and was not. So you got a dozen of us ex-Mormons, 10 I think, 10 of us ex-Mormons going through the temple saying, well, you know, or going through the Masonic temple saying, you know, in the Mormon temple we do this, we do this, we do this, we do this. And the guy who was the Grand Lodge Master Mason said, If there was something we said that he also recognized as a Masonic thing, he'd not say anything. But if it was something that he knew wasn't a Masonic thing, he'd say, oh no, we don't do that. Made it really easy to figure out which parts of the endowment, the Mormon endowment, are Masonic and which are not. And basically, every part of the endowment that has obvious roots in the Old Testament or the New Testament is not Masonic. And everything else, all the handshakes, all the clothing, all that stuff is all plagiarized wholesale from Freemasonry. So, imagine basically 2 hours of handshakes, keywords, signs, and tokens combined with the creation of the world, Adam and Eve, Jehovah, Michael, and Elohim, Peter, James, and John, and Satan. And if you can imagine that, that's basically what the endowment is. Very good question. Are they watching a play? When the endowment was first introduced, we didn't have movie film, you know, in the 1800s. And yes, what they were doing is you'd have one person who would represent Elohim, and one person would represent Jehovah, and one person would represent Adam, and one person would represent Eve. They weren't naked in the Garden of Eden, but they'd say they were. I mean, they were wearing clothing when they were doing this performance. But, you know, so wearing clothing, they'd say, but I'm naked. You know, they're not, but you just kind of assume they're. And so you kind of walk through the Garden of Eden and the coming of Jesus Christ and Peter, James, and John. And while you're at it, you receive keyword signs and tokens. Now, when did they start doing this on film? Let's 60s, I think. I think in the 50s or 60s, they started transferring this presentation onto film. And the experience of going through the temple to do an endowment was very different then. You'd sit basically in a theater, movie theater style seating, and you'd watch the endowment thing done on film. And then every once in a while, they'd break the film, and guys who would represent the actors would come out and give you the handshakes and the keywords and signs and tokens. But for the most part, you were watching a film. Now this ties back to the Los Angeles Temple, because in the Los Angeles Temple, was originally designed to be very interactive and not the kind of thing where you're sitting down watching a movie. But in about the 60s, they converted all the endowment rooms to be movie theaters. And then in about 2003, they switched them all back. So now in the Los Angeles Temple, you actually do have, it's now kind of a hybrid, where you move from room to room when the endowment is done by living actors. So in the Los Angeles Temple now, you move from room to room, but you watch a movie in each room. So it's a little different, but I'm not explaining it very well at all. But if you want to know what is actually done in this whole ritual, do a quick Google search, and it's everywhere. I mean, it's really not difficult to find. Question?
Is there like a page for it?
Yeah. Baptisms you have to be 8 years old to be baptized. Generally, if you're going to do baptisms for the dead, you have to be at least 8, but generally they don't let you do it until you're 14 or so, maybe 12. I think it's 14. But the endowment is first given to you when you do one of the following. One, you go on a mission. Two, you get married. Three, you've simply been in the church long enough and haven't done either of those other two things, and it's clear that you're never going to. Right? So I had my endowments when I left on my mission. I was a missionary. I went on a mission when I was 19 to what was then West Germany. And that's when I did my endowments. If I wasn't going to be a missionary, then I would have gotten them when I got married. And if I never got married, then when I'm about 30, they'd just say, "Oh, go do it." Question.
For women as well.
For women as well, right? In recent years, women go on missions with basically the same frequency as men, but it didn't always used to be that way. So a lot of times, the pattern would be that a man would go on his mission, come back, get married to a woman who hadn't been on a mission, so she would be doing the endowment for the first time. At that point, he would have already done it. But, anyway. Question?
I'm very sorry if I missed something.
I'm about to get there. Actually, that's a really good question. It's my next slide. This, in 1990, this statement was added to the temple ritual. But it's a statement that Brigham Young made in print back in the 1800s, so I'm not actually giving... I am giving away temple stuff, but... Brigham Young stated that your endowment is to receive keywords, signs, and tokens that you can give to the angels who stand as sentinels at the gates of heaven. You can give them the keywords, signs, and tokens, and they will recognize you as one of them and let you through. It is literally a secret handshake that gets you into heaven, I swear to God. I know I'm mocking. I know I'm not being fair, but that's what it is. The endowment. It's 2 hours of here's the handshake. You need to remember this because when you die, you're going to find these angels at the gates of heaven, and you're going to have to give them the handshake. Okay. The question was, please give us the handshake. I will tell you a story. I will not give you the handshake, but I will tell you a story. There's an old Mel Gibson film from 1995 or so called Conspiracy Theory, Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts. It's actually a moderately interesting film. Halfway through, and in which Mel Gibson spouts off a whole bunch of conspiracy theories about the Trilateral Commission and people that are... if you're into that sort of thing, it's kind of interesting. Halfway through the movie... Without saying a word, Mel Gibson walks up to Julia Roberts, gives her this bizarre handshake, and doesn't say a thing. Okay? What he's doing is he's giving away a Masonic handshake. But everybody in Utah thought he was giving away the temple handshake. Okay? Go watch the movie. That's all I'm going to say about that. I will also say, though, that I'm a smart guy. I'm in Mensa, but it took me a long time before I put two and two together and figured out that, you know, that the Masonic symbol is a square and a compass with a G inside it? And that symbol is all over the place in the temple. I'm not going to tell you where, and I'm not going to give you any details about that. But it was so bizarre, because I'd been through the temple over and over and over again, and I'd seen the square and I'd seen the compass, and I'd also seen that Masonic symbol on, you know, people's bumper stickers. And it wasn't until shortly before I left the church that the light bulb went on, and I went, of course the endowment is Masonic. Duh! Okay. Now, then there's the ceiling. So we got through baptism, we got through endowments, then there's the ceiling. In the New Testament, Jesus tells Peter that he's given him permission, he's given him the authority to bind on earth, and when he binds something on earth, it will be bound in heaven. The Book of Mormon has the exact same statement, but it uses the word seal instead of bind. That's what they Helaman 10:7 means. Matthew 16 is where it appears in the New Testament. Helaman 10:7 is where it appears in the Book of Mormon. But basically, binding, sealing is the same idea. Mormons believe that they have the authority to bind two people together forever. Okay? So when you get sealed to your spouse, or you get sealed to your children, that is basically what's happening is God has given to the Mormon priesthood the authority to basically ratify that relationship forever and ever. And that's where Mormons get the idea that their marriages are eternal. Because what they believe they're doing is they go to the temple to get married, except they don't get married in a Mormon temple. The word is sealed. The only place where the word marriage is used is where we're sort of keeping the keeping the government happy, because the government wants a marriage certificate when this is all over with. But in Mormon parlance, you're being sealed, not married. Well, this concept of eternal families, and it's also evolved, and we'll talk in a minute about what happened in 1894, but it has also evolved. But now the idea is that parents are sealed to each other, and they're sealed to their children, and that relationship goes on forever and ever and ever. Now, we want to be able to provide that blessing to our ancestors, so we want to be able to be sealed in their behalf, right? So I need to go to the temple, get sealed to a spouse, have my children sealed to me, and then I need to do all of that for my ancestors. Okay, so that covers it. Now we've got baptism, endowment, sealing the spouse, sealing the parents. Those are the big four that go on in the temple. Now, do we have any questions about any of this stuff so far? Questions? The garment? The question is, when do they get the garment? Mormons, I don't want to get into this. Some Mormon somewhere is going to listen to this recording and send me hate mail for talking about this, because it's either extremely embarrassing or extremely sacred, depending on your point of view. But yes, Mormons go through a ritual immediately prior to the endowment, referred to as the washing, anointing, and clothing in the garment of the Holy Priesthood. And it's at that point that they get the garment, and they're supposed to wear it for the rest of their lives. So that's kind of all I want to say about that, but it's all on the internet.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Questions? Jared? Okay. I don't either. Mormons are simply the question is I'm trying to make sure the recording gets all these questions, and the question is, okay, I get the baptism, I get the sealing, but how does doing the endowment on behalf of the dead give them the knowledge they need to pass by the angels who stand as sentinels? Mormons really don't know. I mean, there's not a good answer for that. Mormons don't know themselves. They're simply told this has to be done, and they go do it. And that's really all it amounts to. Ron? Yeah. The question is about divorces, whether the church recognizes divorces. Yes, it does. But it's interesting because Mormon ceilings are eternal. But when I pick a partner and want to get married in the temple, Mormons refer to this as being sealed for time and for all eternity. And a lot of Mormons don't even know this, but those are two separate ceilings, really. You're sealed for time, meaning for this life only, and then you're sealed for eternity, meaning after that is over with. And in the very earliest days of the church, Joseph Smith used to justify his affairs with the wives of other men by claiming that the women were only married to their husbands for time, but they were married to him for eternity, and they better get it on and, you know, make it official. That particular practice died with Joseph Smith, though. But it's a very interesting, there's a very interesting series of articles about polyandry in Nauvoo that I can get into later. But Mormonism does allow divorce, and if you are divorced, one of the questions you have to answer in order to get permission to enter the temple in the first place is, are you keeping your financial commitments if you've been divorced? The church is very careful to keep, on the up and up as far as, you know, honoring divorce commitments. But what happens is, if you get divorced, you're actually only divorced for time. You're sealed for eternity, right? And that doesn't get broken until, and this is interesting, your sealing for eternity can get reassigned to another partner if you decide to go to the temple and get sealed to that partner instead. But, I know, this is getting kind of esoteric. If you're a man getting sealed to another woman, you don't have to dissolve the first sealing, because men can be sealed to all kinds of women. If you're a woman getting sealed to another man, you have to dissolve the first sealing first, because you as a woman can only be sealed to one guy. Does that make sense? So yeah, Utah does have divorces, Mormonism has divorces, but they're frowned on, but you can still do them. But when you do, it just doesn't carry on into the eternities. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's nothing that prevents you from remarrying. Question in the back. Yes. Yeah. The sealings can only be done by Mormons. Only all the things we've been talking about are all a function of the belief that Mormons have the authority to perform these ordinances, and nobody else does. And so. No. That's not true. Because see, imagine that I've just joined the church and I don't have, I have all this Mormon ancestry, but pretend I don't, right? Pretend I'm a brand new convert to the church. I want my ancestors to be sealed to each other too, right? So I'm going to figure out what their names are, I'm going to figure out when they were married, and I'm going to take that information to the temple, and I'm going to provide proxies to be sealed on their behalf. And that's going to, and the act of going to the temple and being sealed on for and in behalf of one of my ancestors means that those two people who've had the sealing done on their behalf will now be sealed forever and ever and ever, in the same way that I would have been when I did the sealing for myself. In other words, the baptism, the endowment, and the sealing are all done for me first, and then I go back to the temple and I keep doing them for my ancestors, on behalf of my ancestors. Does that answer your question? Okay. Okay, Tom.
You're doing the sealing for the dead.
Yes.
Maybe you're a married man, maybe you're a single man.
Right.
Who stands in for your great-grandmother?
Okay, who stands... Okay.
Your current wife, or do you have one?
No, actually, it doesn't matter.
It's
a very good question. The answer is it doesn't matter. Men can only do... If the deceased individual is a man, the proxy has to be a man. If the deceased individual is a woman, the proxy has to be a woman. That's really the only rule. So let's say that I'm married. I'm not, but let's say that I'm married, and my wife and I go, and we're going to do a sealing for one of my ancestors. That's fine. It doesn't matter whether we're married or not. Let's say that I'm not married, and I and a female friend of mine go to the temple, and we decide to get sealed in behalf of one of my ancestors. It's all the same.
You're going to go through a ceremony that looks just like the ceremony in which you would have been sealed. A man and wife would have been.
Yes. Except I'm doing it for them instead of for myself. Right. Yes.
All the ritual effect.
Yes. I think there's a small wording difference, but yes, basically, this is true. When I was a missionary, when I was preparing to go to Germany, but I hadn't gone yet, we would go to the temple all the time, and male and female missionaries would go, and we did these sealings, and I wasn't married to the female missionaries. They weren't married to me. We were just doing the sealings on their behalf. So, any more questions? The question is, yeah, the question, we got lots of names, are we keeping up with, is the fact that there are billions and billions of people who are dead keeping the temples busy? That's a really good question, and the answer is, I don't think so. And there's a couple of reasons why, and if I ever get through to the family history part of this presentation, I'll talk about that then. But, for a while, the answer was yes. Recently, the answer is no, and I'll talk about why. Hold that thought, because I will get to it. But ask again if I don't answer it through when we get to the family history part. Okay, the question was, here we are doing lots and lots and lots of family history research. We've got billions and billions of names on microfilm. We've been researching all these relationships between people, and we can take ancestral lines back into the 1500s. So that means that we've got lots and lots and lots of names that can be used as fodder to feed these temple ordinances, so that when I go to the temple, I've got somebody who's dead who I can do temple work on behalf of. So that would imply that temples are just working around the clock, doing these ordinances over and over and over and over. In fact, that's not the case. A lot of temples are standing empty a lot of the time. They've built so many of them, they've saturated the market, and people don't have names to take to the temple, if you can believe that, and I'll talk about why in a minute. Question?
Is there any open record of when someone has joined a field research?
Yes. And that's, I think you're talking about the IGI. I think.
That's where, I don't recall. We were chasing Tobias Kelly, dragging us by government.
Okay.
Found him in Arizona, and three women who we couldn't figure out. So we went up to the IGI, and he listed those three women.
Right.
And that's about all we found on.
In other words, what you're saying is you didn't find their ordinance date.
Okay.
Let me talk about it. Hold that thought too, because I will get there. I'm going to talk for a little bit about what happened to the family history department in the church. Okay. I've done the temple thing. I'm going to put the temple thing to bed for just a minute. I'm going to talk about family history a little bit.
If I can go back and find something out there, I will tell you.
I am going to tell you a couple of things that will be interesting to you, but hold that thought. Really, it's 4:17. I'm supposed to quit at 4:30. Help. Okay. Now, so Joseph Smith launches the church with this idea that we've got to go and find our dead ancestors, and we've got to be baptized and down and sealed on their behalf. And then he dies, and the rest of the church goes on to Utah without him. What I haven't quite explained is that prior to 1894, the sealing of parents, of children to parents, was a little different than it is now, in that they were practicing a thing called the law of adoption. Let's not talk about that right now because we're out of time, but trust me, the concept that we have now, where Mormons take their ancestral lines back as far as they possibly can, originates in 1894, where a guy named Wilford Woodruff, who's the president of the church, who incidentally was also the president of the church when they issued the manifesto announcing that they were not going to practice polygamy anymore, which, by the way, was a lie, and was also the president of the church when Utah became a state, and their state constitution said they weren't going to practice polygamy anymore, which was also a lie. Wilford Woodruff was the president through all of that. And in 1894, he got this revelation that changed significantly the concept of searching out your ancestors. And in that same year, a group of people who thought, okay, well, now that we understand that this is something we're supposed to do, how do we get started? Now, you've got to realize, they're living in a desert, there's a railroad, but there's not even really a telephone system, and how do we get information that we need to be able to search out our ancestors? It's not like we can go flying back and forth to Europe every week to research our ancestry. So what happened is a bunch of basically private members of the church privately organized a thing called the Genealogical Society of Utah, whose mission it was to gather as many records as possible as they could in the genealogical library in Salt Lake. And it began very modestly. In the first few decades, they amassed a few thousand books. But, you know, in the 1920s in particular, they kind of gradually kind of got more and more of this, you know, process going. And then, in 1938, the world invented microfilm, and that's when the church really went berserk. Now, once they discovered microfilming, all of a sudden the whole concept of acquiring books went out the window. Well, it didn't go out the window. They've still got, if you go to the Family History Library today, the main library in Salt Lake City, there are bunches and bunches and bunches of books. But there's also 2.4 million rolls of microfilm, and I'm not counting duplicates, that 2.4 million individual rolls of microfilm, and all that began in 1938. Now, in 1938, all they really knew was, we can microfilm, this is really great, but Europe was on the brink of war, so they actually waited until the war was over. But there are some really fascinating stories about how, after the war was over, they went into decimated parts of Europe and found records that had been hidden and squirreled away and hidden in mines and hidden in places where, you know, they were hoping these things wouldn't get bombed. Oh, no, what? Oh, thank you. Okay. There are actually some really interesting stories about what the Mormons were able to recover after the war. But what's really interesting about the microfilming program is how much of the church's resources are involved in going into every part of the world to copy, to make microfilm copies of census records and parish records and everything they can find that might have any kind of a bearing on your ancestry. And they did this because they kind of understood that if we're going to do temple work for these people, we've got to know who they are. And if we're going to know who they are, we have to find their records. And rather than identifying where the records are around the world, why don't we bring them all here to Salt Lake and we can just do the research without having to go anywhere? And like I say, in kind of the same way that the building of temples has accelerated over the last, you know, period, in the time since 1938, the microfilming of records has just gone through the roof. And they've now got microfilms from everywhere. What they did is now they've got this enormous pile of microfilms. They want to be able to preserve them for as long as possible because microfilms are not, you know, they're perishable too. And so they gave some thought to where in the world are we going to put these? We've got this huge pile of microfilms. What are we going to do with them? And they, you know, gave some thought to creating a warehouse in downtown Salt Lake and whatnot. And then they had this idea, why don't we blast a big vault out of a mountain? Because, you know, if you've ever been to Salt Lake, it's in a valley circled by a huge mountain range. And so there are mountains everywhere. And they thought, well, why don't we just, we'll go into the mountain, we'll blast a hole in it, and we'll create a vault up there. And not only that, but what we'll also do, this is in the 50s when we just thought for sure the Russians were going to bomb us at any moment. And we wanted to be able to be sure that we were preserving these records in a way that they weren't going to go anywhere. So we blasted out this vault in the mountains 20 minutes outside of downtown Salt Lake. And as we were blasting the vault, we noticed that there's a natural spring inside the mountain. That, I mean, sure, I'm an ex-Mormon, but I'll call it a miracle. Why not? It's kind of miraculous that spring is where it is, because they weren't expecting it. They just stumbled across it. And that spring not only provides drinking water for people in the vault, not only does it provide pure, fresh water for people processing microfilms in the vault, but it also keeps the temperature and the humidity in the vault at the exact right temperature, at the, you know, the exact right settings for keeping those microfilms preserved indefinitely, but for a really, really, really long time. So in the little, you know, thing, the little booklet that you got where I gave my little blurb about what you're going to find out when you get here, I made this little pun about how the Mormons have a mountain, a literal mountain of family history. That's what I'm talking about. It's the Granite Mountain Records Vault in Salt Lake, which is where they store these millions and millions of microfilms. And the fact that they've got all these records, I think, is pretty freaking cool, because what that means is that I can go to any family history center in my neighborhood, and I can ask to look at parish records from Denmark and Italy and Hong Kong and anywhere I want to, and they're all on microfilm. And I can have that microfilm sent to my local family history center. It's going to cost me $3.50, but I can have that microfilm sent to my neighborhood, and I, without having to travel to, you know, wherever, I can it's right in my own neighborhood. And they've got this whole network of these family history centers everywhere. Get to that in a minute. Now, the thing that I skipped over is the beginning of name extraction. Name extraction, see, here's the problem. Every deceased person has a bunch of descendants. And each one of those descendants is simultaneously working on doing their research of their ancestry, right? So there's a lot of duplication going on. And the Mormon Church is trying very hard to try to find a way to prevent duplicate temple work from being done, because we've already got billions and billions of people that we need to do temple work for. So let's at least try not to, you know, reinvent the wheel and do the same person 100 times. And they had a bunch of kind of attempts at solving that particular problem, right? Because, you know, let's say that you and I are third cousins and I go and do my grandfather and you do your grandfather, the same person, now you've gone and wasted your time, right? Well, the first thing they tried to do to solve this problem came in 1927, where they created an entire library of index cards. And what you had to do is, if you wanted to take a name to the temple, you had to first go to the index bureau and look up that name and see if anybody else had done it before. And it was a very long, slow, laborious process. In 1961, they were just beginning to discover computers. And they had this really cool idea. What if we automate all this temple work that we've been doing? We'll just put it all in one big, gigantic database. And then, if somebody wants to take a name to the temple, we can clear it through this, you know, name processing computer. And if the name processing computer finds that the work's already been done, then we just tell the person, don't go do that name again because it's already been done once. Is this all making sense so far? So name extraction was a further attempt. Okay, before I go on to name extraction, that process that I just described is what eventually became the IGI. The International Genealogical Index is, and this is important, pay attention, the IGI is nothing more or less than a list of everybody whose temple work has been done for the dead. That's what the IGI is. Nobody's on the IGI who hasn't had their temple work done. Nobody who hasn't had their temple work done is on the IGI. Did I do that right? Anyway, it's just one and the same. The IGI is a list of people who've had temple work done. Think about Simon Wiesenthal. I will get to this in a minute. Now, that whole computer name tabulation thing gave birth to the IGI eventually. Name extraction was another attempt to try to reduce duplication. What they were going to do is they said, look, if you get back beyond, let's say, four generations, chances are really good that some other researcher has the same ancestry you do. So what we're going to do is we're going to tell everybody, look, just do your research back four generations, and we'll take care of all the rest. We'll just do all the rest of the research back beyond four generations. All we want you to do is research four generations back and then stop. That rule actually got changed a year later, but it was a nice idea for as long as it lasted, because what the church was going to do is they were going to take all these microfilms that they had, and they were going to extract names from them, because the microfilms are basically parish records, lists of people who were born, lists of people who died, and who were married. So what the church was going to do is they were going to take all the births and the marriages and the deaths off these films, turn them into names for temple work, and just send them to the temple. And then anybody who wanted to go to the temple and didn't have their own name to go through the temple for could use one of the names that had been extracted. And it's a way of simplifying the whole problem so that you didn't have to worry about basically crossing paths with another researcher. If you had an ancestor who was more than four generations back, let the church worry about it, and they'll take care of it. That's 1961. In like 1963, the church said, oh, we don't like that idea because we want you to be personally involved in your own research. So they rescinded it. But a lot of Mormons didn't get the fact that it had been rescinded. And so for decades after 1961, a lot of Mormons thought that four generations were all they had to do. Name extraction was kind of their way of solving another problem they had, which was that a lot of people in the church kind of figured, oh, my work's all been done. I don't actually have to go to the temple because everybody's done my work already. And so they kind of gave up on the idea of going to the temple. But going to the temple is a very, it is for the church a way of kind of getting you entrenched in the religion. And they wanted people to go to the temple as much as possible. So having a list of names ready at every temple meant that you didn't have any excuse not to go. Okay? So it was a way of kind of getting Mormons out to the temple when they were previously making excuses saying, oh, I don't have to because all my work's been done. That name extraction program resulted in lots and lots and lots of names showing up in the IGI. Think again about Holocaust victims. And if you go to the IGI now, and if you know what to look for, you can tell which films, which names on the IGI have been extracted, and you will find that the extracted names, not the ones that are submitted by people, but the ones that are extracted, are extremely high quality. They've done a really good job of making sure that when they extracted names, they transcribed those names very carefully and very accurately, and it's actually an extremely useful tool for genealogists.
Over here, we can't hear you over the
VI. I know. I've explained to Desiree that we really have to do something about this. Okay, I'll try to do this, but... Okay. There, I have a book that I've reread over the last couple of weeks that talks about the. Yeah, you're right. That really is annoying, isn't it?
I got my age turned down.
Oh dear, I've explained to Desiree that these rooms are simply not soundproofed, and I don't know what you can do about them. And
well, I just want to find out.
Sorry. Okay,
What does the IGI tell me about a list of an index?
Okay, that is a really good question, and I will get there. Please hold on. I'm working on it. I was in the middle of answering a question. I forgot what it was. What was your? Oh yeah. If you're doing your own research, you were expected to be a volunteer. You're supposed to do that voluntarily, but. In this book that I have that you're welcome to borrow if you want to, they talk about how the Genealogical Society of Utah employed researchers whose job it was to kind of help people do this research. And those people were paid. They weren't paid a lot, but they were paid. So, yeah, the church has always had employees. And during this period when the Genealogical Society of Utah was not part of the church, which it wasn't until about 1975. When the Genealogical Society of Utah was its own separate organization, it did hire people and it did pay them to help people do research. So yeah, there was some of that. And the GSU had its own staff and they were paid. So yeah, I mean there was kind of. But if you walk into the Genealogical Library in 1930 and say, I want to do my own research. You're expected to do that on your own, right? And if you go to the temple on behalf of an ancestor, you're paying for that too. So does that answer that question?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to get through this. I swear I am. But hang on, we're almost there. So the family history department, especially in the last 20 years, has really gone crazy. Especially now that computers have made their way into people's homes. The beginnings of the IGI started in 1969. In the 70s and 80s, that database was made available on compact disk, and now it's available on the internet. In 1983, when personal computers first took off and people had IBM PCs in their homes, the church was right there with a thing called Personal Ancestral File, which was a software that you used in your own home to keep track of your own ancestry. And then in 1990, they implemented a thing called Family Search, which originally was only in family history centers, these branches of the genealogical library. And in 1987, they stopped calling it genealogy and started calling it family history. That's another story. But then in 1993, they introduced this thing called Temple Ready. I'm going to get to that in a minute. Hold that thought. And then right at the very end of the 1990s, Family Search went online, and the genealogical community went nuts. Because there's so much genealogy data in, on FamilySearch.org, it's amazing. If you're going to get involved in genealogy to start with, FamilySearch.org is definitely a place to go. Now, anybody have any questions? Yeah. How many Mormons are there? The church claims 12 million right now. That's their claim. You had asked about church growth. And whether which religion was the fastest growing. The same website that I want to give to him, I want to give to you, because it talks about how the church is effectively lying about its own statistics. It claims 12 million people. There are not 12 million people. It's my belief that they're counting people like me who have asked to have their names removed, not to be considered members of the church anymore. I think I'm still being counted in that 12 million. I will get it to you. I have to go look it up. I simply don't have it in my head. Any other questions before we move on? Tom?
There's three sets of records. The IMPI is the people who had the work done for you.
Yes.
The extracted names are the ones that the church has found that has not had the work done for you.
And FamilySearch.org is everybody they know about. No, yeah, right. FamilySearch.org brings together all those databases. There's databases we haven't even begun to talk about, okay?
When you get on the IGI, you come off the extracted
name list and it's worth writing stuff. Kind of. Right. Okay, good question. The answer is the IGI is the list of all the temple work that has been done. The extracted name list is everybody they've found on these microfilms. And the names that they found on the microfilms, they have to go through the same process of checking for duplicates. Like if I take my ancestor, I find some ancestor, I want to do his temple work, I have to go through a process of finding out whether he's already had his temple work done. All these extracted names go through that same process. And assuming that they haven't, that they're not duplicates, right, then those names go to a temple somewhere and they sit in a family, in a temple file, they sit in a file waiting for some person to come in and say, I want to do a name, but I don't have a name of my own. Okay? When that temple work gets done, that name goes into the IGI. So the family, the extracted name file is kind of in a state of limbo waiting for temple work to get done.
Well, when it is done, you need to go off of that list. So that
yes.
They don't do the work again.
So you don't do the work a second time.
Now,
and that's what the IGI is for. The IGI was originally conceived and still serves as a way of preventing duplication in temple work. The idea is, if you're on the IGI, your work's already been done, and therefore, if I walk, and this is also important to the whole Holocaust victim thing, okay? If I walk into the temple and I say, I want to do my ancestor, Carl Christian Anderson, who's dead, if his name is already on the IGI, the church won't let me do him again, because he's already been done.
Well, my question is, get it.
Okay.
If you say, I don't believe in the Roman Church, I'm Jewish, I'm Simon Wiesenthal, take me off the IGI.
Right.
To take you off of the IGI, I hope you were already taken off the extracted name list, because you'll have the opposite effect of somebody going to the temple and say, oh, Simon Wiesenthal, nobody's done work for him yet.
And
they'll do it over and over and over again.
This is exactly right. Bingo! Yes! You get special points in the Broyhill Dinette set. Thank you for playing our game. Exactly! Yes!
That's why I think they should take them off of the other list.
What they should do. Okay, what they should do is they should put Simon Wiesenthal and every Holocaust victim on the IGI with a flag that says, don't do this work, ever. But they're still on the IGI so that they're not ever done again, okay? I'm going to get there. But, I swear I am. But I have this really fascinating article that I know I'm not going to be able to summarize because we're running out of time if we're not already out of time. It's an article written by the guy who, from the Jewish side of things, initiated this whole "please don't baptize my Holocaust relatives" thing, and it's a really very moving account of his attempt to try to, you know, balance what the Mormons are trying to do with the feelings of the Jewish people who, what are you doing baptizing my ancestors, and. The church and the Jewish organizations tried to kind of negotiate a compromise. And one of the things that the church recommended was, we're going to put them all in the IGI, and we're going to put a flag next to their name to prevent their work from ever being done again. And the guy who's writing this article said, no, we don't want that, because we don't want our Holocaust victim relatives even to be in a list of any list that has anything to do with baptism, because we just don't want to have anything to do with that whole concept. And this is where, unfortunately, I understand the Mormon point of view, and I'm trying to kind of be understanding of the Jewish point of view, but I can't really say that I fully understand it. But what I do know is that the two sides are not talking to each other as much as they think they are. Because what the Jews want, what the Mormons want, are at odds with each other, and they're trying to communicate, but it's not happening. Does that make any sense?
Rather than have them on the IGI either as done or never do,
yeah,
take them off the list of potential haven't had work done yet.
And knowing what I know about how the computer systems work in the family history department, the only way to do that is to put a special flag in the IGI saying, this work hasn't been done, it's never going to be done, don't ever clear it for work. That's because the IGI is the gateway through which you the word is clearing, basically allowing the work to proceed. And if we don't put them in the IGI or something like it, they're going to get cleared over and over and over again, like you say. So we need to find a solution to this problem. And I'll get there. I will. The Jews have asked the Mormons to make sure this never happens again. The Mormons said, okay, here's how we want to solve that problem. The Jews said, no, wait, we don't want it done that way. And the Mormons said, well, I don't quite know how to solve the problem any other way. What's happened is the names have snuck back into the IGI, just exactly like you're saying. And so in the year 2000, so this whole agreement happened in 1995. In 2000, the Jewish groups came back and said, but they're showing up in the IGI again. And in 2006, Simon Wiesenthal is showing up on the IGI, and it's because there's no really good computerized way of preventing them from getting on the list again. Right? So what's happened is the Simon Wiesenthal Center asked the Mormon Church to take him off the list, which they did, but nothing's going to stop him from making his way back on there again sometime in the future.
And 100 years from now, Simon Wiesenthal 12 converts to Mormonism.
There's actually a provision in the agreement that the Mormons and the Jewish groups signed that says if you can find a Mormon who has an ancestor who was a Holocaust victim, then that temple work can be done, but only in that case. So that's kind of this little provision that's in the agreement. But, okay, question back.
All depends upon the dead person at some point accepting it. What does it matter?
This is the crux of the whole matter. Yes. It's not, though. See, that's the thing. Every Mormon you talk to, everybody who's ever been Mormon will talk like you do and say, but if you don't believe that we have the authority to perform these ordinances, what do you care? But this, the thing about this is, Mormons are extremely centered around this idea of, do I have the authority to perform this ordinance? Authority is the key to everything in Mormonism, okay? And in fact, Mormons refer to the right to do some ordinance as a key. The word key is their code word, their jargon for having the authority to do something. Okay? And the impression that I get from what I've read from the Jewish side of the problem is that authority is simply not, it doesn't factor into the picture. You don't think in terms of, do I have the authority for this or not? And as I read what the Jewish groups are saying in response to the Mormon baptisms for the dead, the Jewish groups are saying, look, the fact that Simon Wiesenthal lived an exemplary life means that he's going to heaven. That's all there is to it. We don't need baptisms. We don't need authority. None of that stuff. It doesn't factor into the equation. So what you're describing is probably what every other Mormon I know would say, which is that if you don't believe that it has any validity, why do you care? The Jews do care very much. And the Mormons simply don't get that. It's sort of there's very much sort of a cross, you know, inability to communicate because we're using different words and different language and we're not really talking about the same concept. It's a very fundamental misunderstanding. But Mormons simply don't get why anybody outside of Mormonism cares, because if you don't believe that we have the authority, what do you care? But the Jews very definitely do care, and the Mormons don't understand that. Absolutely do not get it. Okay? And that
that
is absolutely the problem. That communication gap is preventing both the Mormons and the Jews from understanding each other, and that's really got to change. Question? Absolutely, they do. Yeah, we're not. Okay. Mormons do believe that there's missionary work going on in heaven, right? So Mormons believe that missionaries are in heaven preaching the gospel to people who don't have it yet. So and the way the Mormons look at it is spirit missionaries are in the spirit world preaching the gospel to spirit people who don't have the gospel yet, just exactly like what happens here on earth, right? And in the spirit world, if you decide to accept the gospel because you've listened to the missionaries and you like what they say, then you're in this position where you cannot progress until you have your baptism, endowment, and sealings done. So all those people who have accepted the gospel but don't have their temple work done are waiting eagerly for us to do it for them. See what I mean? So it is proselyting in a very real sense. But Mormons try to kind of ameliorate the problem by saying, look, we're not forcing your ancestors into the church. We're simply giving them the opportunity. It's an act of love. Okay? But when the Mormons went to the Jewish groups and said, it's an act of love, we really are, you know, offering this as a way of kind of trying to, you know, extend the blessings of the gospel, the guy who's writing for the Jewish groups, it's really a very moving statement, and I wish I had time to read it all, but he comes back and says, look, we don't regard being baptized or put on a list of baptisms to be an act of love. We consider it to be an abusive, we consider it to be an act of abuse. This dialogue needs to happen and hasn't been happening to the extent that it needs to happen, because Mormons see themselves as being saviors on Mount Zion, extenders of these blessings and benefits. The Jews see it as an act of abuse. Please don't do that. Don't even put us on the list because we find this very offensive. And both sides are right. You know?
It's hard for me to respect. I mean, the terminology is used by the Jews.
Okay.
And I think there is a difference here between the Jews and the Mormons, because there's a Mormon.
There is.
And it's in Salt Lake City.
Absolutely, there is.
And he speaks to the whole church.
Absolutely, there is.
And there isn't a head of the Jewish church.
Yes.
Anyway.
This is that is a very valid point. And what happened in 1995 is basically a coalition of Jewish groups. And I don't ask me exactly what they are. It's like the American Gathering of Holocaust Survivors or something. There's these groups of Jewish individuals who are interested in genealogy, who are related in some way to the Holocaust. But I mean, they're not the Jews. They're what I'm trying to refer to is a coalition of five Jewish groups who all got together and said, "Look, Mormons, you got to stop this."
And do we know if they speak for the majority of the Jewish people?
I can't speak.
Group or mainstream group?
I can't speak to that. I do have the article here.
Jackson speaks for a while.
No, I know. Yeah, I have the article here. I would love to invite you to read it. I simply don't have time to read it for you because it's like 8 pages long.
Are these all American Jews or are these Israeli?
The Mormon practice of baptism for the dead doesn't confine itself to any country, right? If you lived on Earth, we're going to baptize you eventually, right? So yeah, it's not just Americans. I would urge you all to read. I'm going to give you this. I'm at least going to give you the URL for this story and ask you to read it later, because it really is very moving, and it kind of tells you the story of what happened in 1995 from the perspective of, you know, the non-Mormon side of things. Can I keep going? Are y'all still with me? Okay. All right. Any questions that I haven't covered that are burning in your...
If these people are already in heaven,
yeah,
what's the advantage of them to have them?
Because, okay, the question is, if they're already in heaven, why do we need to keep going? And the answer... Well, see, the answer to that is that in Mormonism, there are different grades of heaven. There's different, you know, levels, different stages, I guess is the best way to describe it. So that... You're in heaven, but you're in kind of a holding area, and you don't get to godhood right off the bat. Once you die, you end up in kind of the spirit world, but you have to accept the gospel, accept a baptism on your behalf, accept an endowment on your behalf, and then you progress to godhood. Okay. I put in a couple of slides in here. Okay. I put a couple of slides in here about kind of genealogy on the internet, just because I knew it kind of had to be, I had to touch on it, but I'm not really sure exactly how much of this I really want to talk about, but I will say that in 1999 or whenever it was, 98 or 99, when the family search thing went online, the genealogical community went nuts, because it really was a fantastic resource, and I just love this cartoon. I just think this is just really cute. This cartoon dates from 1999 from the Deseret News in Salt Lake City, and I just think it's funny. I also threw in a bunch of like websites. If you've never done genealogy before, these are the six places to start, in my opinion. Ancestry.com is a company run by Mormons, but it's not part of the Mormon Church per se. FamilySearch.org is run by the Mormon Church, and all the other ones are not Mormon at all. They're just really good genealogy sites, and you know, if you're just getting started, go here and absorb all this information. Cindy's List is freaking amazing. And if you're just going to write down one thing, write down Cindy's List. Cindy's List brings together every other genealogy website on the internet, and she deserves a round of applause for what she does. She's been doing it for a decade, and it's amazing.
Ancestry owns
Oh, do they? Oh, that's right, they do. I'd forgotten about that. They didn't used to, but they took that over. Thank you. Okay, now, if you are... Whoops, I skipped over a slide. If you are a non-Mormon... Okay, so the genealogy library, which was founded in 1894, moved from building to building to building, and eventually made its home in this enormous building close to Temple Square in Salt Lake City, that was built in or dedicated in 1983 or 4. And all throughout that whole century of there being a family history library in Salt Lake City, people kept saying, look, can you bring a branch of the library closer to me so I don't have to keep driving, you don't have to keep flying to Salt Lake City? And for many of the first several decades of the history of the GSU, they said, look, you know, we're a small organization, we can't afford it, we just can't take on that responsibility. They finally opened branches of the genealogical library in 1963. And they started small, there was like one in Utah somewhere, and one more added. Now they've got thousands of them all around the world. And when you go into a family history, and they're called family history centers now. If you go into a family history center, what you'll see is a few books, a few microfilms, you know, a kind of a basic set of things that they think you might be interested in. But anything that you want that's in the catalog of microfilms, you can have sent to your local family history center. If you're talking about the temple on Santa Monica Boulevard, though, they have the largest family history center outside of the big library in Salt Lake. It's enormous. If you go in there, they have an entire room full of racks and racks and racks of microfilms, and then another entire room of books. And it's just an amazing place to go. Okay. Sure. I promised to come over here, didn't I? So the family history centers are... Okay, that's going to really drive me crazy. No wonder I stand over there. So the family history centers are kind of a way of getting access to the records that are in the family history library if you're not going to drive all the way to Salt Lake. Now, we happen to be extremely lucky to have that big family history center on the grounds of the Mormon Temple on Santa Monica Boulevard because, like I say, it's huge. Now, if you're not going to drive all that far, I decided that I would... whoops, I'm going the wrong way. I decided that I would try to kind of give you an idea about where they are in your neighborhood, but I didn't want to do every single area code because that would keep us here all day. But these are the Family History Center locations in the 626 area code, so that kind of gives you an idea about where they are if you live near Pasadena. And then I did another one for the 818 area code because that's where I live. And there are six of them in the 818 area code. And I've got a printout up here of all of Los Angeles County, all of Riverside County, all of Ventura County, all of Orange County, in case you want to know where there's one close to where you live. Now, that's the non-Mormon view. You go into a family history center, you've got access to the IGI, you've got access to their books and microfilms, and that's kind of what non-Mormons do when they go into a family history center, is they're looking for names. Mormons have an entirely different view of the family history center. Mormons are going into the family history center because that's where Temple Reddy lives. You go into the Family History Center, there's a computer there that is used to determine whether a name has already been done for temple work. Now, this may have changed because I haven't actually been inside a Family History Center for a few years, and they may have changed this in the meantime, but when I was going there, you'd go in, you'd use a computer, the computer would determine whether or not your name was clearable, in other words, whether it already existed in the IGI, and if it didn't already exist in the IGI, they'd let you take that name to the temple. Temple Ready is nothing more or less than a names clearance program, a program that's used for clearing your name to take it to the temple. And by and large, that's what Mormons are there to do, is they've got a name of some great uncle that they want to take to the temple. They go to Temple Ready to figure out if they can, and then they take that name off to the temple. And as I've explained, I think, a couple of times, that action is, there's kind of a circle that goes on, right? I find a name... John Anderson, born in 1892. and he's not in the IGI, so I'm going to take him to the temple, and when he gets all done with all his temple work, that name's going to filter back into the IGI, so he won't have his work done again. Okay? That whole process starts with Temple Ready. And I have noticed in the years that I've spent volunteering in a family history center, because I did that for several years, you can tell when who the Mormons are and who the non-Mormons are. Because the non-Mormons are there to do research, and the Mormons are there to use Temple Ready, and never the twain shall meet. It's really very bizarre. You were actually supposed to laugh at that. I find it funny. Okay, so that's the whole, you know, the circle of the interrelationship between the IGI and the... went too far. Okay. So that's kind of the interrelationship between the IGI and Temple Ready and what Mormons are there to do. Now, questions?
Yeah, I was talking about putting the Jewish name from the IGI and all. You don't have to put the name in. Can't you just bury it in the software so that it is, if someone puts that name in, it's kicked out?
You would think so. Yeah. See, why don't they do it?
Yeah.
Right? Good question.
So
now, I know.
Yeah.
Now, that brings us all the way back to Simon Wiesenthal again, right? Because as I've explained, now I'm kind of losing my train of thought now, but I've got this article that I really think everybody ought to read if I can figure out where the heck I can put it. Okay. The Mormon-Jewish Controversy, What Really Happened, by Gary Mokotoff. www.avotaynu. I do not know what that means. Alpha Victor Oscar Tango Alpha Yankee November Uniform.
Avotaynu.
Does that mean anything to you? No. Well, I. Anyway, that, yeah, it does, and I think it might be, but I don't know. But okay, thatword.com/mormon.htm. is this really fascinating article about Gary Mokotoff's point of view as far as what happened between the Jews and the Mormons. And again, Jews, I'm using, you know, this coalition of Jewish groups. Please read it. Go home. It's really very fascinating. It's very heart-wrenching, actually, to listen to him talk about what he sees the Mormons doing. Yeah, I know. But see, what I've been trying to do for the last couple hours is kind of give you the Mormon point of view on this, which is we don't look at it that way. We don't think of it as a Hitlerian thing to do. We don't see it as a, you know, an abusive thing to do. And it takes a certain amount of maturity to recognize that not everybody sees it that way. You know what I mean? So yeah. Part. I'm sorry. Say that again. Yeah. Metaphorically, yeah. And see that, yeah. And I don't understand why the Mormons aren't doing that, except for two things. Okay, there's two things that I do know about that I can talk about. Number one, Number one, in 1995, when the Mormons signed this agreement, they agreed to tell their membership, only do your own ancestors. Do not do anybody else. Mormons do not do this, though. Mormons are not listening to that guidance. Mormons are just really excited about the possibility of baptizing J.R.R. Tolkien and Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley, and they just really like the idea of being the one who baptized, you know, who was baptized in behalf of J.R.R. Tolkien. They just find it really exciting. Whether or not they're related to him, they do it anyway. And Mormons, some Mormons just kind of catch this fever and want to just go nuts baptizing as many people as they can. And the fact is that Holocaust victims, there is a list. The list is there, right? And as a believing, practicing Mormon, you can take that list, take it to the temple, nobody's going to stop you. And so even though Mormons have been told, please only do your own ancestors, they're not listening. I mean, some of them are, but not all of them are. And so that's one of the reasons why the names keep coming back on the list. But another thing that happened that's really kind of unfortunate is that in 1995, when the church signed this agreement, one of the fallouts of that agreement was the church stopped name extraction. They don't do name extraction anymore. Or rather, they do name extraction, but now they don't take those names and send them directly to the temple. The names are extracted. There's a list of extracted names, but what happens is those names are made available to researchers, but they're not automatically sent to the temple. So what the Mormon members need to do is find that list, find their own ancestors on that list, take their own ancestors to the temple, and only their own ancestors. But what Mormons are doing instead, especially the ones that are just really, 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 you know, feverish about this whole being a savior on Mount Zion idea, is the list is there, and in their opinion, all these people need to have their temple work done. I'm just going to go ahead and do it, regardless of what the church leadership is saying, right? So it's kind of unfortunate that these things are happening, but I think that we can, at this point, we can reliably point to overzealous members. It's not any longer an institutional practice of the Mormon Church to take these names, extract them, and send them to the temple. It was, but that all stopped in 1995, as I understand it. So, but again, there's, you know, the computer system is so large, and there's so many people taking names to the temple, and there's so much of this research being done and going on, that they're trying to kind of get the message out to everybody, please don't do these names. Do these other names if you want to, but don't do these names, and I don't think that message is getting out. So, in 1995, they signed this agreement. In 2000, auditors came back and said, you know, these names are showing up again. The Mormon Church said, oops, we're really sorry, and rededicated themselves to the idea of, okay, we're going to make sure everybody knows they're only supposed to do their own ancestors. And then in 2006, Simon Wiesenthal shows up. What in the world his name was doing in there, I don't know how it got there. Okay? And this is why, I'm going to take you back to my brush with, I'm going to close with my brush with LDS Public Affairs, because I find this kind of interesting. I called up Public Affairs and I said, look, I'm reading this news story as published in the Deseret News, which is the church's main newspaper in Salt Lake City, in which press secretary to the church's first presidency, in other words, the guy who's the main press secretary for the church, says, quote, in accordance with the commitments the church made in 1995, no church ordinance was performed for Simon Wiesenthal, and his name was immediately removed from the International Genealogical Index, end quote. Now, I've already told you, you can't get onto the IGI without ordinance work being done. That's what the IGI is a list of temple work that's been done. So here's Bruce Olson speaking for the church, saying simultaneously his name was removed from the list and no temple work was ever done. Now, I don't understand it. So I called up. At first I wrote to the people who wrote this story in the Deseret News. They didn't respond to me. So I called up the church headquarters public affairs office and I said, how do you explain this? Because my understanding is you can't get in the IGI at all without temple work being done. After getting bounced around to a couple of different people, I finally landed with a guy who works in the public affairs office named Michael von Rosen, who preferred to deal with me by email. And so I sent him my question by email. I said, Bruce Olson said this. He's your boss. He said this. What does he mean? Michael von Rosen wrote me back a reply. His answer was, reading this, Brian, in years past, the point you made would have been correct. Today, the IGI also contains names of people who have been submitted by patrons but who have not had temple ordinances performed. Simon Wiesenthal's name fell into this latter category and was removed before any temple ordinances were performed. I hope this answers your question, Michael von Rosen, Public Affairs. I wrote him back and I said, oh, I think I understand. I think what you're saying is that I take a name to the temple, I haven't done the ordinance work yet, but that name goes on the IGI to prevent anybody else from taking the name to the temple. That makes sense to me. Would you please confirm that that is in fact what you meant? I had no reply at all. Nothing. So instead, since I wasn't getting a response from Michael von Rosen, I wrote directly to the Family History Department. And I said, I'm reading the right one. Uh, let's say someone who lived in the 1700s. Okay, let's say I have a name for a long dead ancestor. Let's say someone who lived in the 1700s. If I take that name to the temple in, let's say, January, and I do that person's baptism in April, endowment in July, and sealings in November, does that name get added to the IGI in January when I bring the name to the temple, or in November when all the temple work has been done, or at some other time? Okay? You with me? You see what I'm asking? I've asked, does it get added in January, or April, or July, or November? And when I was a member of the church years ago, the answer was November. You had to have all your temple work done, then you'd go to the IGI. Now, I believe Michael von Rosen when he says, we broke that up. We're just as soon as you do one of the ordinances, we're going to put you in the IGI. But what Michael actually said to me was, in January, the name gets added to the IGI, not in April when you do the baptism. I wrote to the family history department. I said, so when exactly? Let me make sure I'm finding their answer. Their answer is on this page. We have received your email in regards to when temple ordinances are updated on Family Search. The International Genealogical Index on Family Search Internet is updated regularly as temples transmit ordinance information to us. Some temples transmit information less frequently than others, so dates for ordinances that you have submitted, that you have recently performed, may take several days to appear on the International Genealogical Index. In the context of your question, the work done in April may be transmitted by the temple in April. However, it is dependent on how often that particular temple transmits ordinances to headquarters. Do you hear what I'm saying? Not January. April. I wrote back to Michael von Rosen. So listen, I'm still trying to get an understanding of when it is exactly the IGI gets updated with new information. And I explained to him my question, and I explained the answer that I got from Family History Department. The answer I received states that, quote, the IGI is updated as temples transmit ordinance information to us. They do not say that it's possible for a name to appear without ordinances having been performed. Indeed, in my hypothetical example in which a name was brought to the temple in January, FamilySearch.org has specifically said that the earliest the name might appear in the IGI is when the baptism was performed the following April. See below. And I, you know, cut and pasted the email I got from the Family History Department. So I'm still not quite understanding how it could be possible for Wiesenthal's name to appear in the IGI before any of his ordinances could have been performed. You specifically stated that they were, and I responded with an email asking how that could be done, but didn't get a reply. Could you please take a moment to clear this up for me? Just exactly how did Wiesenthal's name get into the IGI without ordinances being performed if the IGI is only updated when temples transmit ordinance information to headquarters? I'm sure you can understand why this puzzles me. I would very much appreciate your assistance in understanding this point so I can relate it accurately to my audience. Many thanks, Brian Madsen. Guess what? No answer at all. I will leave it to you to draw your own conclusions, but I think you can guess what mine is. And that's basically my story. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you all for staying all this long time. And if you have any other questions, I'm around for the whole weekend. We can talk for as long as you want.